The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about an animal that doesn't get cancer. Which animal, Dave?
Rob, the animal is the naked mole rat. You can actually see a picture of this guy on the site. And not only are these animals not very attractive, they're also very unusual in the mammalian kingdom. Even though they're mammals, they are cold-blooded, and they have a social structure much more like ants than other animals. So it's a very unusual creature.
Now, with all these differences between the naked mole rat and us, do researchers still have hope that they'll be able to apply the lessons that they learned from the naked mole rat to potential treatments for us?
Well, they do, Rob. And that's actually because despite all of these differences, the researchers found something that the naked mole rats have in common with us. And what this is it's a genetic pathway that prevents our cells from clumping too closely together. It's a process called contact inhibition. And it works like this, Rob. Say I were to take a bunch of your skin cells and separate them from each other and then lay them down on a petri dish and have them start growing. The cells would grow and grow and grow and divide until they mashed up real tight against each other and they formed this really tight layer. And then they would stop growing. And that's really important because oftentimes what happens with cancer is these cells don't stop growing. They bunch up and they form tumors or these big layers of cells, which can be very dangerous for us. Well, it turns out the mole rats also have contact inhibition and they use a lot of the same genetic pathways that cells use to sense whether they're too close to each other. But the really important difference researchers found in this study is that the mole rat cells are hypersensitive to contacting other cells. So whereas our cells really have to mash up real tight against each other to stop growing, with the naked mole rat, their cells, as soon as they just touch each other, they stop growing. So they don't even really bunch up that tightly. And the researchers found it's because the naked mole rat cells rely on these two genes to help them sort of sense where their neighbors are. And humans have both these genes too, but we only really express a lot of one of these genes, whereas the naked mole rat expresses a lot of both of these genes. So they seem to have this extra checkpoint that says, hey, if cells are too close to each other, we've got to stop growing. And the researchers think it's this extra checkpoint that prevents naked mole rats from getting cancer. No naked mole rat has ever been observed with cancer, and they live a long time because of this. They can live as long as 28 years. Which for a rodent is a really long time. It's about 7 times longer than a house mouse lives. And it's probably because they don't get cancer.
So if the naked mole rat cells no longer express the products of this gene, they then bunch together like our cells did?
Well, kind of the opposite. What the researchers did was they mutated the cells so that they would grow really close together and bunch up like human cells do. And when they did that, they found a lower level of expression of one of these important genes involved in this contact inhibition. But they never did this on the whole animal level. So they never, for example, did what you suggested and then saw if the naked mole rats got cancer. That would be an important next step. But, you know, all these studies really require a very fundamental knowledge of the naked mole rat genome. And, you know, it seems like almost every day a new species genome is being decoded. And actually, a few researchers have proposed in the past that we also decode the naked mole rat's genome, but it just hasn't been given a high priority, probably because it's such a strange creature. But now with this study and maybe others like it, there'll be a lot more incentive to fully sequence the naked mole rat's genes.
Okay. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from the genetics of naked mole rats to the genetics of grandmothers and their grandchildren, this next story is about why women tend not to give birth after age 40. Now, that's really unusual in the mammalian kingdom because other mammals reproduce until they die. So taking that into account, our strategy doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Now, men are still fertile long past age 40, so something about grandmothers then.
Well, that's the idea. The question is there some sort of evolutionary reason why human females stop giving birth after about age 40? And researchers have been looking at this question for a long time, over a decade. And one theory that's been proposed is this so-called grandmother hypothesis. And the idea goes like this. Women stop giving birth when they get older because at that point, they can actually be more beneficial to propagating their genes if they take care of their grandchildren. In other words, it's more important at that point, rather than them giving birth to children, to actually ensure that their grandchildren who carry some of their genes live long and prosper. But this has been a really hard hypothesis to test, as you might guess. There's been some evidence in foraging societies in Africa, specifically the Hadza society, that grandmothers help gather tubers, which are a really important dietary component of these people's lifestyle. And their grandmothers are busy doing that so that their mothers can breastfeed their children. This whole idea that grandmothers are helping out with the health of their grandchildren rather than producing more children themselves. But studies have kind of been mixed on this. Some have shown this correlation when grandmothers tend to live closer to their grandchildren or when grandmothers live longer, their grandchildren tend to do better in life, health-wise and longevity-wise. But other studies haven't shown this correlation. So in this new study, researchers said, is there a way to really disentangle all this data and figure out if there actually is this real correlation between grandmothers and the health of their grandchildren?
Where's all the data coming from?
Well, what the researchers did was they really drilled down into the genetics, and they looked at the sex-linked X chromosome. Now, all of us have, if we're women, we have two X chromosomes, and if we're men, we have an X and a Y chromosome. And so it turns out that actually not all grandchildren are related in the same way to their grandparents. So let's take this example. You have a dad, and his mother has two X chromosomes. So she passes along one of those X chromosomes to the dad, who is XY. So he's got his mother's X chromosome. Now he, in turn, is going to pass that X chromosome down to his daughter. His daughter is going to get the other X chromosome from her mother. But he can't pass that X chromosome down to his son because his son is going to get his only X from his mother. And what this essentially means is this X chromosome has pretty much passed directly from grandmother to granddaughter. And that makes the granddaughter 50% related to the grandmother, at least for her sex chromosomes. But when you have the grandson now, because he didn't get this X chromosome, he's 0% genetically related to his grandmother, at least on these sex chromosomes. So as you can see, and there's a lot of intermediates when we're dealing with grandparents on the maternal line, but just for sake of simplicity, you can see that there was a lot of differences in genetic relatedness between grandmothers and their grandchildren. And so the researchers wanted to know, well, you know, if we're talking about evolution here, the grandmothers really are only going to, in an evolutionary sense, want to take care of those grandchildren or ensure the health of those grandchildren that are most genetically related to them.
The daughters of their sons.
Exactly. And that's indeed what the researchers found in this study. What they did was they looked at seven modern day societies and some historical societies as well. They looked at farming villages in Japan and Ethiopia and Malawi. And they also looked at some historical villages as far back as the 1600s from Germany and England. And when they compiled all this data together, they did what's called a meta-analysis. They found that paternal grandmothers were most beneficial to the survival of their paternal granddaughters and least beneficial to the survival of their paternal grandsons, while maternal grandmothers showed an intermediate effectiveness. And this all flows directly from how genetically related these grandmothers are to their grandchildren.
So if I have a daughter, then I can expect potentially some help from my mother?
Yes, but not if you have a son.
Oh, well, I'm sure she'd help out anyway.
But Rob, the important thing to remember here is that researchers don't think grandmothers are making these decisions consciously, that they don't know. They don't go, oh, grandchild X is more related to me than grandchild Y, so I'm going to take better care of grandchild X. But they think there might be something going on a sort of a more subliminal level. Maybe grandchildren that are more related to their grandmother give off some sort of scent, or they have some sort of, you know, physical resemblance to their grandmother that's very subtle, you know, that's causing these grandmothers to do more either directly or indirectly for these grandchildren than they would do for grandchildren that are less related to them.
So not deliberately.
No, not deliberately.
Okay. Well, last story then. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from why grandmothers might prefer certain grandchildren, at least subconsciously, to why we prefer white wine with fish.
Now, I thought there were some red wines that could be had with fish.
Well, it's complicated. You may have heard the old admonition, white wine with fish, red wine with meat. It doesn't always hold true. There's certain fishes that work better with some wines than others, but it tends to hold as a general rule. And in this study, researchers were trying to figure out why. Is there something about pairing white wine with fish chemically that makes more sense than pairing red wine with fish?
So not the flavor combination, but something about the wine itself.
Something about the wine itself. And I've never had this experience, but maybe you have, Rob. The idea goes that if you pair certain red wines with fish, you get this really strong fishy aftertaste that can really wreck the meal.
Particularly with scallops.
Particularly with scallops, exactly. And so to figure out exactly what was going on here, a team of Japanese researchers recruited 7 experienced wine tasters, and they gave them 38 varieties of red wine and 26 types of white wine. And over 4 sessions, they had the volunteers drink various combinations of these wines with, as it happens, scallops. And it turns out that these tasters did have some very negative reactions with certain pairings of red wine with the scallops. And so the researchers looked at these wines that had really produced the negative reactions, and they did a chemical analysis. And the correlation they found is that the red wines that were especially high in iron were more likely to produce this fishy aftertaste with scallops than other red wines or white wines, which tended to have much lower concentrations of iron.
What's the iron doing? How's it reacting with the fish?
Well, that's what they still don't know yet. They suspect that the iron might somehow be causing the breakdown of an unsaturated fatty acid. And when this happens, that could release decaying fish smell, which would ruin any good meal. But they're not sure exactly what's going on right now. They've gotten to this first step where they said it appears to be iron, which is the issue. And now the next step is to figure out, okay, what exactly is iron doing when it makes contact with scallops that's causing this unpleasant aftertaste?
So even though they haven't isolated the how, they're able to stop at this point and say, we think it's the iron.
Exactly. But if you look at the comments on this article from our readers, there's a lot of very strong opinions about just how applicable this study is to our everyday dining experience. So check that out. But as reported in the story, at least one outside expert thinks that the science is sound here.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got stories on the most distant astronomical object ever observed. And also, just in time for Halloween, an ancient fly with a very bizarre appearance. It had a horn and 3 eyes on that horn. There's a neat little picture of him on the site. And on Science Insider, we've got a story about how the U.S. actually needs fewer scientists rather than more scientists, a very controversial study there, and also why science at the Department of Homeland Security isn't being peer-reviewed. So check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.